Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled A Feminist Struggle for Nonviolence, Domestic Violence Legislation in the United Kingdom. This lecture is delivered by Dr. Anel Boshoff.
Okay, so I'd like to welcome you to this evening's session of the Work in Progress seminar series. Today is going to be a special session, and it's meant to coincide with the visit to our university of Dr. Anel Boshoff. Dr. Boshoff is a law teacher, although she lectures in Wales, she is originally from South Africa, which has a number of similarities and affinities with us from a legal point of view, because they are a mixed legal system which combines civil and common law elements. My initial interest in Dr. Boshoff's work was from the standpoint of comparative law. And then when she first came to Malta around 2 years ago, I discovered that she was also interested in philosophy of law, particularly legal hermeneutics and feminist legal theory. And since then, I discovered that she is also working in constitutional law, constitutional interpretation, and also in family law. So it's with great pleasure that I hand over the microphone to her and basically tell her how much we're looking forward to what she has to say.
Thank you very much. Thank you. First, thank you to Dr. Zomit for inviting me. As he said, it's my second time in Malta. I'm very pleased to be here. I hope to come again one day. but my talk this afternoon, and thank you very much for all of you coming. My talk this afternoon, when I heard that this is discussing work in progress, I took it quite seriously. So this is indeed work in progress. So there's no, you can see, I mean, I won't go through all of this. This is quite a lengthy paper, but I'll give a shortened version, just talk through it. But you will notice that when I come to the end where it says conclusion, that part is still completely blank. And I was hoping that we can have some kind of discussion and feedback and some talking about it that might actually inspire me to write a conclusion on this. Now, the title of this unfinished paper is called A Feminist Struggle for Nonviolence, and which is a little bit misleading. It also needs a subtitle that it particularly relates to the legal position of violent victims in the UK, and especially victims of long-term domestic violence that then kill the abusive partner. Now, there's quite a lot of literature surrounding this area, also in psychology and so on, the battered wife syndrome and so forth. So it was against the background of this whole phenomenon and also the legal rules surrounding that, that I wrote the paper. The paper, however, is not primarily concerned really with it's using this this example of the reaction of a victim to violence to make quite a larger point surrounding concerning the relationship between law and violence. Now, law has always concerned itself, obviously, with the theme of violence, and this kind of managing of societal violence is often seen as one of the first or the core tasks of the legal system. Now, that means that the perspective, the relationship between law and violence has really been theorized from almost all possible perspectives. And it is difficult to say something about a field where so much has already been said about it. But nevertheless, I had a perspective that I wanted to put, which I think is looking anew at this relationship between law and violence, by asking two questions, two very broad questions, and those are the ones I haven't got answers to yet. And that is the first one: does the law have a role in facilitating the possibility of nonviolence in its most radical or utopian form? And second, can such a possibility be related to the broader political project of feminism? Now, what I mean by an utopian ideal of nonviolence is really moving from a basic hypothesis, which there's no grounding for, it's just a basic hypothesis, that physical violence in all its forms and committed by anyone should be avoided as far as possible. And then I will assume that the law, in its widest possible sense that we can understand the law, is relevant to this project of promoting a vision, really, of a nonviolent society. Now, my investigation focused on violence in a gendered context, number one, and second, on violence between intimate partners, so-called domestic violence, as we understand it, as a legal term. Now, it took me a while to decide to use this example of domestic violence, and the question whether adding the dimensions of gender, number one, and the dimension of domesticity, like really this violence in closed space, would narrow the parameters of the problem too much. And when I thought about it again, I decided it will not narrow the parameters. It will rather kind of explode the complexity of all the psychological and the philosophical aspects that relate to it. Now, I then decided that in order to explore the prospects of a kind of radical nonviolence, which obviously will be in an aspirational or a messianic kind of way, it is necessary to go to the most unlikely source of this, and it becomes necessary to investigate sort of the moral, the ethical, and the political decisions made by the violent victim. In other words, the decision to retaliate or to whatever you would call the violent reaction of the victim. Now, I was fully aware in this that violence committed by a victim, whether it's in self-defense or in retaliation under conditions of extreme provocation out of necessity, falls within a completely different moral category than violence committed by an aggressor. And that there is quite a danger, a very real danger, that focusing on a violent victim and violent females in my example, especially where their actions are considered to be morally justified or excused by the law or the moral system, might create the impression that victimhood is unimportant and that the oppression and violent intimidation of women cannot legitimately be resisted. So there was a risk that looking critically at the actions and responses of victims will in fact increase their vulnerability and will work against an ideal of universal emancipation. So those were the concerns I had in the start of this. Now, also, if we look at the prevalence of domestic violence, and I've only got statistics for the United Kingdom, but it is almost unbelievable. If it didn't come from an official source, it would be unbelievable. The statistics is that one in four women and one in six men are likely to experience domestic violence, and it is estimated that two women are killed per week by their partner or former partner. Which I almost don't believe, but it comes from the Home Affairs official statistics, so I will believe it, but it is very hard for me to believe. The Home Affairs Select Committee reported, and this is slightly outdated, it was in 2008, it's already 5 years ago, that domestic violence is the highest cause of death worldwide in women aged between 19 and 44. It's greater than the number of deaths caused by war, cancer, or road accidents. So this is an amazing statistical number of women that we're talking about. Now, if we speak about war crimes or domestic violence, if we just take it as a whole for the moment, both war crimes and domestic violence are admittedly committed by women as well as by men. But the statistics remain notably asymmetrical, with female victims by far outnumbering male victims. It's therefore no surprise that the legal system focuses on, both in domestic law and in international law, on eradicating gender-based violence against women. Now, keeping all that in mind, I nevertheless persisted in thinking that it is important to examine the ethical implications of a victim's response to an aggressor. So I put into question whether a victim of violence have a responsibility to make an ethical decision whether or not to retaliate, although it might seem counterintuitive to our kind of natural sense of justice. However, in order for a more extreme state of nonviolence to even be thought, we must think of ways to kind of break a cycle of violence, which and the burden, if you want to call it that, of that rests as much on the victim as on the aggressor to not necessarily to stop it, but to be mindful about it in some way. So this example I want to use, the position of women who kill their partners after they have suffered sustained periods of severe domestic violence, is really almost the most harrowing of all possible cases. I thought that this kind of case is sort of at the edge of our tolerance or intolerance, our moral tolerance. And it is really here, right at the edge of what society will allow, that we can re-examine traditional or orthodox reasoning about it, and it might be possible to gain some new insight into this. So the article, as it is at the moment, is divided into three parts or three kind of themes. I like to think that the three themes are complementary. I must say that a colleague of mine read it the other day and thought the three themes were completely unrelated. But they related in my own mind. So maybe there is some way that they are. In the first theme, and this is the easiest one for me to do, being some kind of lawyer at least, the first theme gives a brief overview of the current legal rules considering a possible defense for victims of domestic violence who have killed their partners. And there's been extremely interesting legal developments in the UK with a brand new piece of legislation, quite radical legislation, that came into operation in 2009. So it would be worthwhile even just to look through this kind of legislation to see what the state of that is at the moment. However, then there's a second theme, which becomes much more theoretical. And in the second theme, I focus on this instant of decision making. There comes a moment, and it is really just a moment, where you've got to decide, what am I going to do now? And I very much want to keep apart the legal system, which in a way we can, I don't think one can totally equate it, but the legal system as it evolves almost gives us the moral state of society at that moment. So here are the moral rules that we work with. But even with those moral rules, there is still an individual decision, what I would call an ethical decision at that moment, what you going to do or not? How does the victim choose to respond, if one can even use the word choose, to this position of vulnerability and maybe even potentially dangerous circumstances that she might find herself in? Then there's a third theme, which I think at least relates to the second theme, if not the first one. And the third theme relates to a political response to this. My thinking here is, and a political response in the sense of a political feminist response to this, my argument is that if this violent victim needs to make a decision, an ethical decision, how she's going to respond to violent conditions, the conditions of possibility need to exist for her to make the decision. And those conditions of possibility is not a singular for one person to make. Those conditions of possibility need to exist politically. So in a way, it moves from morals to ethics to politics as the three related themes. I will start with the first one, which for non-lawyers might be slightly tedious, so I'll try and run through it. The second one on the ethical moment of decision-making is very theoretical and is really built on Derrida's distinction between law and justice and the interrelation between law and justice. And in the third one on politics, I use some work of Nietzsche and a little bit of Wendy Brown on identity politics and so forth. So not quite sure if I'll get through all of this. And when we get tired, I will just quit at some point, maybe. Right, now let's look at the legal position first as it is in the UK. Now, it used to be traditional I don't know what we would call them, very often called battered wives, and I do argue that we should go away from such kind of terminology, but that violent victims of long-term domestic violence used to have no choice but to use a defense of provocation. Right. Now, how the law used to work is that provocation is a partial defense to murder. Now, what is meant by a partial defense? If a person in English, the law of England and Wales, found guilty of murder, there is a mandatory life sentence. So the judge does not have any discretion. There's a mandatory life sentence. However, if one successfully uses a partial defense, so let's say the victim used as her defense that she was provoked, provocation, then then murder would be converted into manslaughter. So she'll be convicted of manslaughter for which there is no mandatory life sentence. So the judge will then have at least some discretion on what sentence he would give. Right. Now, this provocation as a partial defense has always been very troublesome part of the criminal law. And I'm not first and foremost a criminal lawyer, but this is just so very basic criminal law. Now, the reason for this, why it's difficult to use provocation, is that there's great uncertainty about the theoretical basis of this defense. So on the one hand, the defendant who has now killed, who's accused of murder, can be partially excused. And excuse is a very technical term in English law, can be partially excused because of diminished responsibility. Now, at the time it happened, because of years and years and years of extreme abuse, this person has had diminished responsibility. And then on the other hand, and paradoxically, and it doesn't make sense at all, the defendant's act can also be, or must also be, partially justified due to an element of reasonableness in behavior. So at the same time, there's a subjective and an objective element that does not really go together, because at the same time, you have diminished responsibility, but however, you've got to show that in the circumstances, the reasonable person would have done the same as you would have done. And it's really difficult to show that the reasonable person would have had diminished responsibility under this position. So the two elements just did not gel very nicely. Now, the position was changed a little bit in 1957 with the Homicide Act. And in the Homicide Act, a separate partial defense was created called diminished responsibility. So we now had two, diminished responsibility on the one hand and provocation on the other hand. And that made much more sense because you show different things in these two defenses. However, it was still very, very difficult for women under these circumstances to use either of those, and I'll explain that just now. In 2009, a brand new defense was created by the legislature called the Coroners and Justice Act, and a brand new partial defense was created to the charge of murder called the loss of self-control. Now, this loss of self-control completely replaced both provocation and diminished responsibility. So there are no longer those defenses in English law. There's only a defense, a partial defense, of loss of self-control. However, in loss of self-control, these two aspects of diminished responsibility on the one hand and justification or reasonableness on the other side now again collapsed into one defense, which logically is a problem. Right, now I'm not going to go into the background of how the Law Commission decided to do that, but the introduction of this new defense received very mixed responses. There was a big group of people that were very pleased with it, saying that they were very outdated rules, reforms were long overdue, and so forth. A lot of them feminist groups, and also defense lawyers and people like that. So some of them argued that the previous legislation was much too narrow. For instance, the legal rules, you could still use a loss of self-control if the loss of self-control under diminished responsibility arose from anger. So you lost your temper. I killed while I lost my temper in hot blood, but not where it arose from fear or harm, or fear of harm. So if I was scared, I'm not allowed to kill, but if I'm angry, I'm allowed to kill. So there is something, and the Law Commission's remit was specifically look at the moral aspects of the law. And looking at the moral aspects, they decided that this is just not morally defensible. Now, from a feminist point of view, provocation was a big problem because the requirement was, and quoting from the previous legal rule, that there had to be a sudden loss of self-control in immediate response to a provocative act. And that is much more normal in male violence. You know, you lose your temper and you lash out to somebody. Yeah. In the situation of domestic violence, it's what they call slow burn reaction. It goes slowly and slowly and slowly. And if you look at some of the cases, it almost seems as if it's done in cold blood, because, you know, in case a woman would make supper and she would take her husband a cup of tea and wait patiently for him to sleep and hit him over the head with a pan. Don't let that make you nervous. but that is the kind of thing. Yes. Or poison, yes. So statistically, it's quite high. But if you look at, the quality of it, it's a much lower level of violence. And also men's reaction to it is very different. Rather than living in fear, they normally live in shame. So they have, and that's why so much of it's underreported, because men find it quite shameful to admit that, you know, I'm the victim of domestic violence. You know, in feminist theory, there was absolutely no doubt that this whole defense of provocation is gendered. Provocation is a common law defense, so it has been there for time immemorial. But it is absolutely geared at the way that men understand violence, not the way that women understand violence. So generally, and I'll explain just now exactly, in broad terms, how the new act worked, but it was generally got quite a good response from feminist groups and also from groups supporting victims of domestic violence and so forth. There was also a group, mostly criminal lawyers, who thought that the reforms did not go far enough, mainly because this mandatory, there's a big problem with the mandatory life sentence. And because a murder has a mandatory life sentence, all sorts of, wiggling needs to be done in the law to prevent that. And they thought if the mandatory life sentence is taken away, then everything else would become easy. So all of this problems in the criminal laws really because of that. And also the Law Commission actually made a recommendation to the government that that should happen, that should be a full reform of the law of homicide. And I had a chat with the person who was at the time the chair of the Law Commission, and he said they were bitterly disappointed in the government's response to their recommendations. And they thought it should have gone much further, but this is. So this new partial defense based on loss of self-control has got three criteria that must be met before it can be done. The first one is the defendant's act must result from her loss, his or her, loss of self-control. Now, this was already a big step because there's an absence of the word sudden. So there's no longer that it's got to be sudden. It's got to be loss of self-control, but not sudden loss of self-control. But there is a requirement that say the defendant must not have acted in a considered desire for revenge. However, the jury would be able to know what that means. The second one is that the loss of self-control must have had a qualifying trigger. So something must have, and the previous provocation also had this trigger. And it then gives a list of three possible triggers. The first trigger is, and this is quite important, where the defendant fears serious violence from the victim against the defendant or another person. So we no longer only have anger, but also fear as a possible qualifying trigger. Now, that doesn't really make sense because a qualifying trigger is something that happens like this, and fear doesn't come like this. Fear comes over a long time. So there's a bit of a mismatch between qualifying trigger, which is like a switch you push, and fear that is a long-term thing. And then the third possibility for a qualifying trigger is that thing or things have been done or said, so you see not only physical violence, which were of extremely grave nature and caused the defendant to have a justifiable sense of being seriously wronged. Now, again, the word justifiable means it's got to be reasonable in some way. The reasonable person in this condition would have, responded like that. So we again have the reasonable man, yes, criteria. Yes.
What's the second trigger?
No, this is the second one, sorry. The third one is a combination of the two. So it could be a bit of one and a bit of the other one. And then the third requirement is, and this is the one I really want to focus on. The second one is, and a person of the defendant's age and sex, with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint, and in the circumstances of the defendant, might have reacted in a similar way to the defendant. So there we have the reasonableness requirement. But the two aspects to the reasonable requirement, not only a person of the defendant's age, because age is a legitimate factor, a child reacts different than an adult, but also of the defendant's sex. So it's got to take into account that this is a woman. Now, there are a few points about this that's been made quite a few times, but I'll discuss them nevertheless. Prior to the 2009 Act, the sex of the defendant was considered to be a relevant characteristic, which could have an effect on the defendant's capacity of self-control. Now, this is problematic because the assumption was that these special concessions must be made to the female sex due to the psychological profile being different from that of men. That's still okay, but special emphasis was placed on women's innate passivity and helplessness, which by implication would make them less resilient and less able to exercise self-restraint. This is bad. This is terrible. This is like a stereotyping of the of the half-crazy woman. Yes, yes.
So,
yeah.
This is the new one.
No. This was in the old one. It was say there was a characteristic. Here we're not quite sure what it means in the new one. I'll get to that one. Now, in the case DPP versus Camplin, which was in 1978, so this was under previous legislation, the court said, women are generally regarded as highly strung, emotionally fragile, fickle, hysterical, and less able to control themselves in the ordinary sense of the word. Now, of course, women...
Yeah,
this was from the judgment that the court gave. Now, this judgment was given in favor of the woman because of these characteristics. You know, she couldn't help it because she was fickle and less able to control herself. And so, now it was also pointed out that there were repeated references in the House of Lords, when they discussed this legislation in the House of Lords, to women who are pregnant, menstrual, or menopausal, and thus have lower capacity for self-control, so almost seen as pathological in a way. Now, on this point, the Law Commission's recommendation was, and I also discussed this with the Law Commission's head, that the reform should retain age as the only characteristic and drop sex. So it's only age that is relevant to self-control. It suggested that the jury can take the defendant's sex into account, but only as part of, and I'm quoting from them, the relevant circumstances of the defendants. Now, this seems like a very small difference, whether it's a characteristic or a circumstance, but it is very crucial to see it as the circumstances rather than characteristics. So the loss of self-control defense and its explicit link to women made this perpetuate a sort of double standard of aggression. There is a more generous interpretation that women would like to give to this piece of legislation, where they would see the inclusion of sex as indicative of circumstances rather than the indicative of having the capacity of self-control. I already said that. So the circumstances that they're talking about relate to gender-specific matters such as, and quoting from her, the relative size and strength of the parties, simply that women are physically more vulnerable, which I think, even if psychologically, leave out that, but physically they are size and strength of parties. The existence or not of a state of dependency, which could be economic, emotional, or psychological. Now, the inclusion of sex into this section on this reading can be seen as sort of more gender awareness rather than stereotyping, to indicate persistent patterns of gender inequality that's still prevalent in society. And there is something in the legislation that indicates this more generous, maybe, interpretation of it, because it requires the jury to consider the circumstances of the defendant. Such as part of It does not say anything about the psychological characteristics of the defendant, but looking at the violent circumstances the defendant has been confronted with, so her actual way that she lived in these circumstances. So the jury may bear in mind the history of the cruel conduct, how long it's been going on and so on, previous behavior of the defendant, the exhaustion and fear under which the defendant lived, and all those things are objective circumstances rather than reflecting on the weakness or the passivity of the defendant herself. The loss of self-control can therefore be attributed not to the defendant's weak female character, but to the defendant's reasonable assessment based on past experience of her own safety and the need to protect herself and others. My argument is that this kind of reasonableness that I'm after can only happen if the conditions of political conditions of possibility exist where it can. So therefore, it is the sort of political aspiration of feminism to create conditions where it would become possible. Now, exactly what that conditions be, we won't get bigger and stronger in that way. Maybe it's not only down to that. It might be that there is some kind of society one can imagine which can create the possibility. And what I'm after is not a sort of condemning women for doing it if it's necessary, but being in a situation where it's possible to make a decision. Because I think many of these women, there is no decision-making possibility. You see, that is a point for me. When the court focuses on the characteristic of the woman that this happened to, it is almost makes it her responsibility. And the problem is not she didn't cause the problem. So the problem does not lie in her psyche. The problem is a much wider, what I would call a political problem in the wide sense of the word that you use, politics, and therefore requires some kind of political solution. And it's really not very good for women, seeing that more than half the population are women, and they take this. If you take loss of control on face value, what we think it means, what it was previously the diminished responsibility, it's really logically impossible, because I, especially having it as a partial defense, because either you have lost control because you have lost your mental capabilities, in which case it should be a complete defense, not a partial defense, because either you can or you cannot function as a rational subject at that time. So if there's a factual finding of diminished responsibility, it shouldn't be a partial defense, you should go free. Because it's like being temporarily mentally disabled. Many women that were interviewed said, I've never ever felt in control like the moment that I did it.
Not control over their lives.
But you know, must also remember, for that moment they experience a sensation of being in control, the consequences for them and their children and family and wider society is extremely devastating. So at that moment they can't weigh up, I'm going to go to jail for the rest of my life, my children are going to go into care, we won't see each other again. So the price for that moment of control is very, very, very high.
But what is the alternative? Does society provide an
alternative? Well, the alternative, not at the moment.
Does the law provide an
alternative? Not at the moment, but...
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. You see, it's those cases that triggered the idea of it being a syndrome, of being the battered wife syndrome, and it got written into the psychology journals and so forth as a specific psychological thing. And then there was a big reaction against that, because what happens, it becomes medicalized. You need a medical expert to diagnose you as being ill. So then it's got nothing to do anymore with the violent perpetrator in the beginning. It's you that is ill. It's got nothing to do with the violent circumstances. You ill. And the second thing is it gets individualized. So this is in an individual mad woman. It does not reflect women's status in society or the wider position or whatever. So it's taken out of the political debate where I would like to have it, into a private medical debate that's not useful at all for anybody.
Yeah, being called mad.
Being called mad, yes. So this is just one crazy woman, so okay, let's excuse it because of her diminished responsibility. And however much that might help the individual woman because she might get out without being punished, although that's unlikely, she'll have a lesser sentence. She'll have a lesser sentence or sent to mental institution, being medicated and so forth, where she's not the one that had the problem. And the rest of the problem would be forgotten. This thing of a binary divide, where on the one hand, he would have reason, emotion, objective, subjective, culture, nature, and so on. So we know that Western society, from as far back as we can go, has functioned in this binary code.
Yeah.
Went along with it. Now, the question is whether this binary division is gendered, no? And I do this experiment with my students. I don't say anything. I just write the two lists. And I ask them, which side do you think a woman on? And they always know. They always choose the emotional, subjective, culture, and so forth side. So there's that division. And then you ask them, from a lawyer's perspective, which side is privileged? Which is the best side to be on if you want to become a lawyer? And then they choose rational, yeah. Objective, yeah. The male side.
They're not,
yes.
They're not yet the underdogs.
Yeah.
The males are not the underdogs in our society. They are the
But then from a feminist strategy point of view, there's been two big strategies. The one is to say that sort of liberal feminists say, yes, we accept the binary structure. And we accept that the one is privileged over the other one, the rational one, but we dispute the genderedness of it. So women can be as rational as men, as objective as men. Men can be as emotional as women. Then there's a different perspective, a sort of the more radical feminist perspective that says we accept this as well. There is a male side and a female side. We agree that. But the hierarchy does not exist. So objective is not better than subjective. It's different. So in fact, they go so far as to say that subjective is better than objective and nature is better than culture. Well, I must say, in the UK, there was domestic violence in the house next to mine. I still lived in town then, in a townhouse, so my neighbors were right next to me. And there was a lot of... It was very violent. And I mean, I just arrived. I was culturally very different from British people. So in this street, everybody else closed their curtains, whereas I ran out to see what's up, you know, and my daughter as well. So we were standing there. So we were the only witnesses to what happened, because everybody else ran in and closed the curtains. Yeah, so afterwards the police came to interview us and whatever as witnesses. But what was good, the police came, and the man actually broke the front door. And they brought in a woman, a policewoman, that went in with her and stayed with her. And then the police came at about 2 a.m. They fixed the door. And then they put a policeman outside the door that stood there the rest of the night, because she was really scared that he's going to come back. And he just stood there and the entire night, you know, looking up and down that nobody comes, which I thought was a really good, I thought it was a very good response. As an emergency response, it was really very good. I just think, you know, that the problem is when you think in ways of power. So that if woman gets more power, that by definition she's taking the power from the man. And it's not necessarily, you can imagine it in a different way, that it's not a power struggle between the two and who's got it. And many things that I think that men have a disadvantage with, something like childcare, that we see as a burden maybe, and this and that and that. But it, in some way, once two people share it equally, and it's almost a privilege in some way. And I'm not overly sentimental about my children. They were naughty little buggers. You know? But men that don't share in that kind of And I think once they start doing it, life is completely different. And as long as you don't experience it as my power is being taken from me. And I think from the man's point of view.
Yeah,
because he's given women now have experiences they haven't had before of being in the workplace, of having economic power and so, but there are many, many experiences that men haven't had and that they deserve to have as well. I think it's interesting, and I have, because if you look at much sort of deconstructive writing or so, Derrida, for instance, said there's no, you should move away from men and women to the multiplicity. And feminists were very upset about this because they said you don't move from the one to the two, you move from the one to the many. So the women disappear in this. There is a lot of argument towards just see it as somewhere on the spectrum, the sexuality. But there's a lot of feminists like Luz Irigaray and them that really say, well, the fundamental distinction in the world is male and female. And she speaks about what she calls hospitality, which Derrida speaks a lot about, being hospitable. And men and women need to be hospitable, but you can only be hospitable if you have a place. So women cannot be hospitable because they do not have their own place. If you get married, you go to your husband's place, your husband's family. So you cannot get this relationship of being different but equal, which is what she wants, without being not similar, being what you are, being that very feminine, being at some way on the spectrum, but actually having your own psychological space. In which case, you have the freedom to invite somebody into your space. And she said, women has got the problem, they cannot invite somebody into their space because they haven't got a space. Well, and initially my idea was with this, the problem I had with this is with the cycle of violence. And it's really difficult to break the cycle of violence. It has happened in history, and one could use different examples of the cycle of violence in my own country. My home country, we did break the cycle of violence, although it's not very good now. But as far as political violence go, Mandela came, and he was the victim, and in some strength of will, he broke the cycle. Because he did not identify himself solely as victim. He could see actually a future beyond himself being the victim. And then it got to me that is the thing that breaks the cycle of violence. If the victim can imagine herself as something else, as victim, and she does not, her whole being, her ontology is that of victimhood that takes up her entire identity. Because the moment victimhood takes up your entire identity, then you become almost justified in everything that you do. Because I identify myself as victim only. It's not the fact that you are a victim. You are a victim. Everybody was a victim of
the situation and continuing to live and taking it all.
Yeah. But then the whole rest of your life, you keep that as an identity.
An identity of a survivor, you mean?
It might be, but I mean, in a way. It means that you close your options very much of how you're going to see yourself for the rest of your life and what your future and the future of society around you in relation to you is going to be, because you will forever after be the victim.
No.
You're the victim. You're the victim of this has happened to you. Right. And you are a victim. But you do not identify that is my entire identity. Yeah. No, this is the main part of my identity that I have been victimized. And I think it might be unreasonable under certain circumstances to require that of women.
He changed the law,
He did.
So
he did.
This is what
exactly.
We have to do, change
so
the law.
What my argument right at the end is, it changes, what I think will change it is if you change the argument from I am to I want.
Exactly. Exactly, I want.
So it goes from an identity problem, I am this and this and this, to a political step, I want. And that is for me the thing that
will change,
to break the cycle into saying, I'm not going to be forever after identified as I am weak, I'm a woman, I am this, I am that. I'm going to say, I want this. And that is where the conditions of possibility comes. Yes. And I mean, in the UK, it does happen. It does happen, yes. That he's got, there's an order that... where he's physically, and it doesn't even matter who the owner of the house is, the violent person will just be removed.
Well, I think we should just thank Dr. Boshoff for a really stimulating, lecture and discussion. And I want to thank all of you for sharing.
To me, I think so. I think I do. Thank you very much. Yes.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled A Feminist Struggle for Nonviolence, Domestic Violence Legislation in the United Kingdom. This lecture was delivered by Dr. Anel Boshoff.